This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What do you think? This week was top three in terms of White House-induced economic uncertainty? I'd say so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryznov. Friday, the 2nd of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what do you say about a week where the President of the United States, without any indication that the decision had been thought through by policy experts, announces trade tariffs that leave basically every constituent part of the global economy going, wait, what? Well, here, we call that Friday. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. They are both in our studios in a very windy Washington, D.C. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Anna, what do you think? Top three in terms of White House induced, right?
It was a very exciting week. The president may have known what he was going to do when he walked into a meeting with steel and aluminum executives on Thursday, but a lot of his advisors did not. And there was a lot of confusion related to that up until his big announcement on TV. And I think it really reflects kind of the ascendance of this group of people in the White House in recent weeks who would have the president take a tougher stance on trade. And maybe also that the president is going back to some of his original impulses. He's had these beliefs about trade and tariffs for a long time. And there have been a group of free traders who had thought that maybe they had convinced him otherwise in recent weeks. But I think this shows that they might have less influence than they think.
Yeah, perhaps. That's Peter Navarro, of course, and Stephen Miller by name. But Sudeep, let me ask you about another name at the White House who clearly does not maybe have as much oomph as we thought and who a lot of people had been counting on to be the economic grown-up in the room, Gary Cohn, the chief of the National Economic Council and former Goldman Sachs guy.
Yeah, look, President Trump has set up his administration to have warring factions. That's one of the features he seems to have loved throughout the campaign and throughout his business. Put some people in the room who he thinks are smart, let them fight it out. But there are some core beliefs here that the president is bringing up when it comes to tariffs. Let's be clear here, the president is not the only politician to be fighting the last war. That's a fairly frequent occurrence in Washington and across the country. And obviously, in this case, he's hoping some tough talk will force action that helps these industries, steel and aluminum, that he's promised help to. But obviously, it also just carries some huge risks. A trade war has enormous consequences across the world. It signals this move away from a free market system that has been the underpinning of the global economy for decades. And people are going to have a lot of difficulty coming to terms with that.
Anna, I will point out as I turn to you that you cover global trade for The New York Times. We've had you on many occasions talking about that. You were at the most recent round of NAFTA negotiations. So the question then is, and we're going to get to Canada later in the program, but what does this do for other trade deals that the White House is talking about? NAFTA is under renegotiation. Secretary Mnuchin says, yeah, you know, we might get back into the TPP. What do you think?
Well, it's unlikely to be much help in this regard. These tariffs, as the president had discussed them, would not exempt any countries. We have to see what would happen next week. But they would be very broad and conceivably hit a lot of allies and trading partners. And already in the last day or so since the announcement, you saw retaliatory threats already coming from Canada and the EU. The EU picked this was thinking about it as a James Dean trio of blue jeans, bourbon, and motorcycles.
Right.
All products that are designed to kind of inflict maximum political harm and put some pressure on political officials. Harley Davidson's made in Paul Ryan's home district and bourbon in Mitch McConnell's. So we'll see if those threats of retaliation are influential in changing some political opinion.
Do you think, Sudeep, that as this announcement marinates, I guess, over the next week or so. We've been told the official policy is going to come out next week. Do you think it might evolve to be more targeted? It sort of seems like the market is thinking after yesterday when they went, oh, my God, today they kind of went, maybe it's going to mellow.
Yeah, we've been through 13 months of this. The president says something in a meeting. It sounds really good. It's very good marketing to the people he's trying to reach. And then the people who do the details get into it, soften it, change the tone of it. We haven't gotten any signs yet that it's happening. So we kind of have to see if we get in that direction. But these last 13 months have been head scratchers for a lot of businesses. We have what seems like a pinball approach to economic policies. You've got tax cuts companies love one week, and then the next you've got tariffs that most companies hate. Businesses say they want certainty. They want predictable policy. This is not certainty. This is not predictable policy. And it just runs the risk of triggering some anxiety and spurring a backlash across the country and around the world.
It is the certainty.
Companies that brace for it.
Right. It is the certainty of uncertainty. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Anna Swanson at the New York Times. Thanks, you too.
Thanks,
Kai. Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. Wall Street, as I mentioned, I think it's fair to say they have been rattled by the trade news out of the White House. They did, though, shake off the heebie-jeebies by the closing bell, traders did. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to spend a lot of time on these tariffs throughout the show today because, I mean, come on. The president let fly on Twitter this morning, as is his wont, talking specifically today, tariffs and trades. Here's what he said, quote, when a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. Example, when we are down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore. We win big. It's easy. End of quote. And about that quote, we put it to Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to unpack two things. First, the trade wars are good and easy to win, and that we can just not trade anymore and win big against a country we have a multi-billion-dollar trade deficit with. Here is Mitchell.
Proposition number one, trade wars are good and easy to win.
That kind of tweet reflects a completely antiquated notion of trade.
Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute says global companies today are interdependent for raw materials and component parts.
You know, the U.S. buys steel and it sells steel to other countries as well.
In the form of finished goods, cars, airplanes, household appliances, that U.S. manufacturers will have to charge more for because they'll be paying more for steel and aluminum. Which brings us to Proposition 2. Don't trade anymore. We win big. Take Germany and its $64 billion trade surplus with the U.S. Cutting off trade could starve U.S. companies of Germany's top exports, like auto parts and medical devices.
This is where it's going to hurt. Fabricated metal products, electrical equipment, appliances and components, machinery.
Joseph Bruswellis at RSM says a trade war could then escalate to other products and countries.
If there is retaliation, it's almost certainly going to be in agriculture. You look at places like Iowa and Missouri, Kansas and Nebraska, Oklahoma and Texas.
Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group sums up on the notion of trade wars good.
There is no way it can be done without harming the U.S. economy.
Helping a few industries, like steel, but hurting manufacturers, retailers, farmers, and consumers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now that we all know trade wars aren't easy to win, in fact, there are no winners in trade wars, I'm obliged to mention that who boy are the Canadians annoyed. We buy the biggest chunk of our imported steel and aluminum north of the border. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said today that the proposed tariffs are, quote, absolutely unacceptable. The foreign minister promises to take responsive measures. Nice though Canadians stereotypically are, all of that translates to this. We hate it. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has the Canada trade update.
Canada's the largest supplier of U.S. aluminum and steel, but it doesn't just sell.
They're also the largest buyer of U.S. steel. It's a very balanced trade relationship.
Laura Dawson, director of the Wilson Center's Canada Institute, says we make different types of steel. In general, Canada buys more of our exports than anywhere else. The only country we import more from is China. Plus, Canada's a longtime ally. Derek Scissors is with the American Enterprise Institute.
We used to say that our allies were reliable suppliers. Like, are we really going to say that in a national security emergency, we can't trust the Canadians to send steel and aluminum across the border?
He says that complicates the Trump administration's argument that these tariffs are necessary to protect U.S. steel and aluminum industries because those industries are essential to national security. Even the United Steelworkers Union, which supports the idea of these tariffs, has argued they should exempt Canada. Union President Leo Gerard spoke with Marketplace Morning Report.
We're not necessarily enamored with the broad brush approach. We think we ought to go after what we euphemistically call the evildoers.
Countries that are engaging in unfair trade practices and pushing down the price of these materials.
I would assume if there is to be exemptions granted that Canada would be at the top of the list.
Jennifer Hillman is a professor at the Georgetown Law Center.
Having said that, that is a complete violation of our international trading rules.
As a member of the World Trade Organization, we're not supposed to play favorites with other member countries. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
It's been 2 weeks now since the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School down in Florida. And during those 2 weeks, the students have made themselves visible, calling for gun control measures and support for the victims. And they've helped raise millions of dollars on GoFundMe, much of it going toward organizing a march in Washington, D.C. later this month. But with all of that money coming in, how is it being managed? Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
It's the first week back at school since the shooting. An hour after the bell rang, I caught senior Diego Pfeiffer on his cell. He says his English teacher is no longer making the class read Macbeth or any gory work.
We're gearing a little more towards comedy. We're trying to keep the air a little more lighthearted.
Pfeiffer says he's been shocked by how much money he and his classmates have helped raise. There are multiple GoFundMe pages connected to the tragedy, but the one for the D.C. march has already brought in more than $2.8 million.
What people don't quite understand is how freaking expensive it's going to be. From what we hear, there are going to be like 14 jumbo screens.
And 2,000 chairs, 2,000 portable restrooms. The GoFundMe money doesn't even include the $500,000 pledges made by George and Amal Clooney, Steven Spielberg, and Oprah. Jeff Kasky is the father of the student who organized the GoFundMe page.
The kids are not kids. I mean, these are young adults who have something to say, and, you know, good luck stopping them from saying it.
To help them say what they want to say, the group has brought in attorneys and a public relations firm. They're also creating a foundation to manage the donations. Meanwhile, the Broward Education Foundation, a nonprofit arm of the school board, has already raised $3.5 million. That'll go toward families of victims and others impacted by the shooting, says PJ Ryan, the foundation's director of marketing.
We're no stranger to large sums of money. However, something of this magnitude and sensitivity, it's new territory.
Territory, she says, that she wishes she never had to visit. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The overt sexual harassment has really declined, but the stories I heard from women are those of, let's call it, economic harassment.
Wall Street and Me Too. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 70 points today, about 0.3%, closed to 24,538, fairly mellow all in all once things bottomed out early in the session. The Nasdaq gained 77 points, 0.1%, rather 1%, 72.57. The S&P 500 13 points higher, 0.5%, 26.91. For the 5 days gone by, though, the Dow off 3%. The Nasdaq gave back 1%. S&P 500 down 2%. We talked about Canada a little bit here with some big Canadian companies and how they fared. Hudson's Bay, one of the oldest trading companies around, off 0.7%. Royal Bank of Canada withdrew 1.1%. Rail manufacturer Bombardier Transportation, also they make airplanes, declined 0.5%. Bonds fail yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. we push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I mentioned yesterday at the end of the program that the Pew Research Center has decided millennials are only going to be people who were born between 1981 and 1996. That prompted a discussion in our morning meeting today along these lines. First of all, who made Pew the decider on this? And also, what is the economic value of a demographic label? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
A baby boomer, a Gen Xer, and a millennial walk into a bar. They can all get in because in order to be classified as a millennial these days, you're between the ages of 22 and 36. At least that's what the Pew Research Center has declared. Pew Research Associate Ruth Agelnik says divvying up the population by age is useful.
Generational analysis is a great tool for us to use to analyze changes in views over time.
But the definition of millennials as people born between 1981 and 1996 is far from official. The U.S. Census doesn't recognize it. It's just Pew's, says Jonah Berger, professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business.
There are dozens of firms, if not hundreds of firms out there, that profess to be millennial experts and use different definitions of what a millennial might be.
He says grouping by age makes it easier for businesses to conceptualize who they're selling to.
Categories make people, whether we're just individuals or companies, feel more comfortable. It gives us a sense of understanding and comprehension, even if we haven't actually learned more by categorizing it than not.
But Arante Bennett, who teaches marketing at Villanova University, says companies shouldn't think about these generational categories or cohorts exclusively in terms of age.
It's age and values and lifestyle. So you go from moving from a demographic to a psychographic, and age cohorts help us capture those more nuanced differences.
Bennett says we're getting to a stage where businesses can customize a message for a specific individual, but doing that on a mass scale is still prohibitively expensive. So until the price drops, firms will likely continue to put people in those handy generational buckets. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
With the Oscars on Sunday and the Me Too movement getting maybe a little bit of extra attention because Harvey Weinstein, we are going to turn to the new issue of Vanity Fair magazine and a story by Bethany McLean about the terrible harassment women on Wall Street had to deal with when they first started to get into finance in numbers in the 1980s and 90s, and what it is like for women on Wall Street now. Bethany McLean, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Is it better for women on Wall Street today than it used to be?
On the surface, it's much better. Wall Street is much more bureaucratic than it used to be. Huh. The Me Too movement, in a weird way, started back in the 1990s when women began bringing lawsuits, the most famous of which was the so-called Boom Boom Room.
Yeah.
And the overt sexual harassment has really declined. But the stories I heard from women are those of, let's call it economic harassment, because you're a woman and your career is hurt in ways ranging from a boss who won't be alone with women to ways in which plum assignments are just directed to men. And so those subtle forms of discrimination are almost in a way harder to fight than the more overt things.
I wonder if it's different somehow in the financial field specifically because, you know, it goes back to the old Masters of the Universe thing, right? It's you are rewarded for your toughness, for your willingness to, you know, tear somebody's heart out and, you know, bankrupt them and all of that.
I think that's definitely something that is a reason why women on Wall Street have not spoken out en masse. You adopt the traits of the dominant culture, right, for survival. And the dominant culture is one of toughness. And you're going to take pride in how tough you've become. And then there's no way you're going to complain because you wear your toughness as a badge of honor.
You actually tell a story of a woman who's, I think the word she used was, I was an assassin for this firm for 30 years. I would have done anything. And then something changed, and now she says, I'm a sheep now, right?
Basically, that's what happened. It was a woman who did everything right. And this was one of the heartbreaking things about the story for me was that you can make a lot of mistakes, as I did when I was a young person on Wall Street, or you can basically do everything right. And doing everything right doesn't always save you. And what I mean by that is this woman was tough. And she was a huge producer at her firm, did very well financially. And yet, when she thought she had the place in the firm to speak out about behavior on the desk she worked on that she found inappropriate, racist comments, sexist comments, she found the boys' club closed its ranks against her, and it's changed her attitude toward her job. And that's what I mean by the subtle ways in which women's careers are derailed. You work a little less hard, you're a little less all in because it just becomes too painful.
You have experience, as you said back there. You were a junior analyst on Wall Street at Goldman, right, in like the early 90s?
I was. That was my first job out of college.
And?
Well, I found it a tough environment. For many years, I would have said the problems I encountered were my own fault. And what I mean by that is when I started, I was in a less than ideal work environment, and ended up with a senior man who essentially told me I was failing at my career and extended an offer of a friendship, but one that came with strings. And I think for many years, I would have thought that this situation, which really damaged my self-confidence, was all my fault, that I should have handled it better, I should have done something different. And it was actually fascinating when the Me Too movement started last fall to think of this through that lens and think, oh, wait, he was a senior man who had a girlfriend. How was this okay?
So let's get to the as-yet unasked question in this interview, but you talk about it in the piece. Where and when are we going to get the Harvey Weinstein of Wall Street?
I actually do not think we will. I would be shocked if there were a Wall Street figure, a current Wall Street figure with stature of that magnitude, who was engaged in actions that were that egregious. I just think Wall Street cleaned up, cleaned up that aspect. But that doesn't mean that life has gotten better for women on Wall Street. And I worry that there will be a myopic fixation on sexual harassment in a way that ignores the other issues that can hold back women's careers or might even exacerbate them.
Bethany McLean at Vanity Fair, writing about Wall Street and Me Too and how things have changed. Bethany, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Can't think of steel and aluminum in this economy without sooner or later talking about Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, right? The city was built on those metals. Even though today it's more of a mecca of tech and healthcare, news of the tariffs yesterday resonated. So Marketplace's Erica Barris went out to see how news was playing. She sent this report from our desk at WESA.
Richard Brown spent years working at a steel foundry, but these days his connection to the steel city has nothing to do with metal. He's in construction. Wood. His take on President Trump's move to slap tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum?
I think it's wrong that he do that, to make it cost more to get it from the other countries.
Brown says it'd be great if steel made a comeback, but the reality is it's not. Not in Pittsburgh, anyway. The headquarters of U.S. Steel and Alcoa are still here, but that's about it.
We need the stuff to ship from the other countries. The other countries got all the metal and the steel and everything else.
And it's on display in the self-driving cars that pass me as I talk to Beverly Anasillo. As she makes her way from the fish market to a specialty Asian grocery store, she says the tariffs won't make much of a difference because
Pittsburgh is no longer a steel city. They've closed so many plants. This is basically white collar.
But the thought that tariffs could make things like a can of soda or a toaster cost more, that concerns her. It concerns Angel Robertson, too. She's a sidewalk flower vendor and says she can't afford for her living costs to go up. Even so, she's behind the tariffs.
We should be promoting business inside of America and rebuilding what we have here.
Wearing the local uniform, a Steelers hat and coat, she tells me,
my entire family worked in the steel industry, so, you know, seeing Pittsburgh being less of a steel city kind of hurts my home pride.
It may also hurt something else. Paul Dausch, who runs a company that makes T-shirts touting every variation of I Love Pittsburgh, says, big picture, a trade war is going to be painful.
Well, I think it'll just be a tit for a tat. This guy's going to raise this tariff. This guy's going to raise this tariff. It's going to hurt here, hurt that country. It's going to hurt Canada.
But he adds, President Trump's latest trade move isn't complete yet. And Trump has been known to change his mind. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out today, which requires a little bit of a setup. A couple of years ago, we did a story where I rode around with a paparazzo, literally just rode around in his car all over the west side of L.A. looking for celebrities to take pictures of. And at one point, this happened.
I can be. Why? What's going on?
It's just Zach Galifianakis. He's at Rose Cafe.
Zach Galifianakis at Rose Cafe? Yeah, you know what? I'll pass.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Call ended.
Why'd you pass on Zach?
Can't give him away.
Really? That's pretty funny.
It's what we colloquially refer to in the industry as Jamba Juice money.
That's just so cold. Not worth my time.
So that was a couple of years ago. You can see the whole video, by the way, at marketplace.org. This, what you're about to hear, was this week, Zach Galifianakis on the Conan O'Brien Show.
A friend of mine sends me an NPR link. He emails me an NPR thing, and I click it on, and it's a video. I don't know. NPR is doing a video. I don't know why. They're the radio. But Kai Rizdahl, it's a guy on NPR, some blowhard. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
He follows the paparazzi around for a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the paparazzi gets a call. Hey, we got Zach Galifianakis at Rose Cafe. The paparazzi guy goes, no thanks. That's coffee money. Stop making fun of me, NPR!
Zach, I'm sorry, man. I just don't know what else to say. Although I will say pretty cool he pronounced my name right, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow off 70 points today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ gained 77 points, that is 1%. S&P 500, 13 points to the good, about 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.